South Africans doing great things.
Karabo Mokonyana is my guest. She's a legal and development legal practitioner from 4RE4M Envoy and Program Director for SESI Fellowship. And she joins me now on the line. Karabo, thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me this evening. I really appreciate your time.
Good evening, O'Brien. Good evening to your listeners. Thank you so much for having me.
So I'm quite familiar with the SESI Fellowship. What is the RE4M Envoy?
So it's Reform Envoy. So that is basically...
How do you say it? Reinformer?
So Reform.
Oh, Reform. Ah, okay.
Reform Envoy. So it's basically a development consultancy firm. So we're just advising a lot of like governments, multilaterals on how to better do their job, basically, in line with what is happening on the ground. And because we are on the ground and a lot of the policies are not aligned with what the reality is, basically.
Isn't that sort of the reality in general as far as policies in various levels of governance are concerned? And I'm not just talking about government, but in various levels of governance, in corporate governance, in civic society governance, even in some corporate spaces, that policies are made in boardrooms that seem to be so far removed from the realities of the ground, that you need people like Karabo to try and bring alignment. Isn't that a reality of policy making and policy makers, specifically in our country? And maybe it's not just in our country, but generally, is that something that you see?
Absolutely. And I guess that's why we started the consultancy firm, because it's quite frustrating, you know, seeing how the policies have so much gaps, firstly, but also how removed from reality a lot of the policymakers are. And then there's obviously this big thing around implementing a lot of it. And a lot of the times they don't have the capacity to do so, or they just really, it's not translating as they've written it. So we want to kind of bridge that gap.
Yeah. What does that say, Karabo? I mean, when you guys have these conversations, and I'm sure you do, because you'd obviously have to try and understand the reasons and the drivers behind this misalignment of policy and the realities on the ground. What does this say about just the policy-making framework that we have in our country? Because it is so rife, this reality of misalignment of policy and realities on the ground is so rife, from government to any form of governance. That seems to be the reality. It's almost part of the norm.
That's true. I think what we've observed mainly is the fact that a lot of the processes are not really inclusive. So you have policymakers who need to tick boxes in terms of getting through procedure to get this thing on paper. But a lot of the times that process is not necessarily inclusive. It doesn't really involve multiple stakeholders. And therefore, it's hard then for it to translate into the ground and where it is actually supposed to be implemented. I'm a strong believer that those that are basically a lot of these policies are meant to impact need to somewhere somehow spear the implementation. And if you don't even involve them in designing these policies, then they can't really take ownership for any of the things that you've written in that policy. They don't have the resources and the capacity to even do it. There's already a gap in them translating that into implementation on the ground, because the people who are most affected, the people who these policies are meant to benefit, were not even involved in the design, and now they're meant to implement or just take on whatever that is being implemented. So just the continuity and the flow and ownership of these policies really lacks.
I'm intrigued, and perhaps not in the most positive way, by how endemic this reality is. As I said earlier on, that it's everywhere, right?
Yeah.
Is it because the intellectuals, the academics, the elites that are involved in policy creation simply don't believe that those for whom these policies are being created are able to contribute, or is it something else? Is it perhaps because they believe that people just don't have the intellectual or experiential understanding of the policy-making process and framework? What is the reason for, at least one of the reasons that you've pointed out, the exclusion of the people for whom these policies are made? What is the reason for it? And I'd be interested to find out which space you would point to that most loudly represents the issue we're talking about right now. I'm looking at, for example, the issue of the 16 days of activism, right? It happens every year. And we see all sorts of campaigns happen every year. Not too long ago, we saw the summit that the president was hosting around the issue of gender-based violence and so forth. And ultimately, the reality in that policy framework was that people sat around, came up with all sorts of ideas, created policy, but nothing was implemented or implementable. What is the reason for it? Why is it that we're not including the people that must be the recipient of those policies in the policy creation?
So I'll say, I'll definitely piggyback on what you've mentioned in terms of, I guess, I'd even call it undermining, as is, in terms of the intellectual engagement with, you know, people at community level. There is this thing of policymakers not necessarily effectively engaging them because of that intellectual or knowledge gap that exists. I mean, the gap already in terms of just how policymakers approach people on, you know, at community level is very large, in that you have somebody who is very academic, not necessarily being able to translate some of the things into, you know, ordinary conversations with people. So therefore, there's been a bigger gap in terms of even being able to effectively engage in such things. But I also think the budget allocations and the priorities around inclusion, I would say they don't really allocate a lot of money towards realizing inclusion. There's much more money in terms of service providers, in terms of the 100 meetings we always see, but I don't see a proper dedication towards inclusion.
Why?
I would say it's more around ticking boxes. So we have a system of very much ticking boxes to say we've done this. As to whether it's substantive or not, we don't really care, because it's very much an image-based thing, but also you need to seem like you, I mean, politics comes to play. You do need to seem like you're doing the work. And a lot of the time, there's not a lot of accountability in terms of like public accountability to say you're meant to do this. And that's where you then see civil society coming in. Because I think then without civil society, you wouldn't be able to see a lot of the stuff that is happening behind the scenes. But a lot of our, you know, institutions really do take a ticking box approach. And then a lot of the finances is dedicated to things that are not really effective, especially with regards to meetings and conferences and summits where we just talk. And then it's like budget is finished and you really don't even have money left to engage people who are most affected by these things.
So what do you guys do? What do you guys do? And I'm crossing my fingers because I want to remember a theory that is playing around in my head as to why we are seeing this phenomenon, not only in our country, but in the rest of the continent, where people are financed by various countries or organizations, philanthropists, and whatever the case may be, for a particular policy implementation, and then the money just disappears, or it's just badly implemented, or you know, you are more closer to this situation, and you could perhaps tell us the reasons why. But I've got a couple of theories that I want to throw at you, and I want to hear your thoughts about that. But what do you guys do? What is it that you guys do in order to try and mitigate against this misalignment of policy and implementation?
Okay, so with Reform Envoy, we basically are, so we are taking obviously consultancies from your governments, your corporates, these specific institutions, with the knowledge that, you know, a lot of the time they want to either outsource these services to other people or they will do it badly. So we kind of want to take that task. And actually then either we do research gaps to say, okay, this is what you've done, it's not working, how do you then improve it? Or then we come in to say, okay, this is a policy you've done, these are the things you need to implement, we will implement for you. And I guess, and then having this sort of service, we have a big accountability because we're not a non-profit. Reform Envoy is not a non-profit. It's a proper business. We are providing, so the governments and these different companies are our clients. So we need to basically make sure that these specific outcomes that they want are actually met. So then we will do research, we'll do the project management, we'll do the consultations on their behalf. We will do, you know, research, community needs-based analysis. We'll do all of that stuff that they basically most of the time do not want to do that contribute effectively to a lot of these policies and a lot of these project plans and frameworks come into play.
And obviously what you do for government and these organizations, corporate organizations, is what they ought to be doing themselves?
That's true. But I think the capacity gaps is a big thing because a lot of the times they do not have the capacity to take on these programs. Because everybody already has other things that they're doing. So then I think that's another reason why some of it is then badly implemented, because you have a specific team that is meant to maybe do policy reform or that sort of thing that is also meant to then implement a program. Then there's always a focus on one thing, and often then it's the high-level stuff, which is meeting attendance, policy writing. It's never really the grassroots, tangible stuff that makes impact.
Give me an example of a project that you managed, let's say for a government department, that was successfully implemented, that was in line with the original policies, or perhaps maybe not original, and maybe you guys tweaked them here and there, panel beated them here and there to make them relevant to the ground on which you are supposed to actually make this policy live. Give me an example.
Okay, so there was actually a consultation. I mean, it's different governments and UN agencies. So there's like UNICEF, UNDP, Department of Health and Social Development.
Yeah,
it's around comprehensive sexuality education, and that is basically us having education around sexuality, not necessarily sex work.
Right.
And we needed then to facilitate proper conversation with people who play an important and integral role at community level. And one in particular, besides parents, which was done at school level, one of which was then religious leaders and traditional leaders, because they had a point and a view around this conversation, because comprehensive sexuality education was viewed as sex education, and that was then, you know, condemned by traditional leaders and religious leaders. So then we had to facilitate that conversation. It was almost like an intergenerational type of dialogue where you have conversations with different stakeholders, and you also then have conversations with those specific people being religious leaders and traditional leaders, so that everybody kind of then understands the rollout of these programs, but also we hear from them to say, okay, how then do we get to a point whereby there's an uptake of this program, but also the effectiveness of this program, how then different players at community level are going to contribute to this program, because it's not just a teacher-learner thing. It is very much comprehensive, and we do need to then take into consideration how it affects everybody, the community, the context. And that specific consultation really went well. You know, it really, really went well. And we were able then to advise on, you know, what traditional leaders and religious leaders could actually do in terms of contributing to this, but making them also understand why comprehensive sexuality education is so important in the context of teenage pregnancy, gender-based violence, especially at school level.
So my mind is just going to that traditional leadership space, that religious space, where there are ideas and perhaps worldviews that have been held for thousands of years that may be in direct contravention to some of the ethos of what you're trying to bring to those spaces. I want you to go a little bit deeper and just make it a little more practical for me. What were you trying to teach? What were you trying to get people to get, to buy into in practical terms? What were you wanting them to understand and do, and how successful were you?
Okay. So firstly, we used a strategy called intercultural dialogues, and that is almost like, a lot of the times whenever we get into these sort of consultations, everybody just wants to get their views across.
Yeah.
And what we needed to do then is acknowledge the views that came from traditional and religious leaders to say, you know, their views actually matter in this conversation. We're not here to just convince them. We also want to hear their side. So then we initially then presented. So there's an entire textbook and curriculum that was ultimately piloted at several schools to see how this project would actually affect, you know, nationally. And then we were basically presenting to these specific, you know, traditional leaders and religious leaders how this specific pilot went, but also then making them understand, breaking it down, breaking some of the myths around comprehensive sexuality education, but also then bringing to light some of the issues that exist outside of having, you know, such education at schools. We brought it back to, I mean, we even had learners that came there to make them understand how much this program or this subject would be to them and how would it impact them from a gender-based violence. I mean, the subject in itself speaks about essential things like consent, what is consent, and it's very age-appropriate. So we all had to do is really break it down to say, this is what the curriculum looks like, this is what it does for a learner, and this is what, you know, we hope it achieves in terms of, you know, building our society, because we have social behavioral issues, and that's what ultimately leads to a lot of the gender-based violence that we see in our society. So we're breaking down a lot of the stuff by then starting at school level. So what we then had to do is really present that to them, but also understand their concerns. And in understanding their concerns and making sure that we then advise our clients as to what is the best way for everyone to have an uptake in terms of the subject, how it helps learners, what can we change, but also how then we can involve different key stakeholders at community level.
What? And I'm going a little even deeper here. What were you trying to teach Dikgosi and Barut about sexuality?
Let me just put it out there. So the reason why they were specifically involved, besides being community level, we've obviously been seeing, abuses at churches, also things like Ugutwala and things like. So they also then play a part in terms of some of the things that have been happening at community level. And we basically then are highly involving them in that regard to say, yes, you're there, you know, Lebogoshi, you know, Lebaruti, Kokrege and stuff, but there are these things that are happening, and some of it are happening directly under your nose, in the church, you know, in the traditional communities, and we need you then to play your part in this conversation. And you may not understand then, you know, what comprehensive sexuality education is, and we want to make you understand, but also bringing to light the fact that you must be aware that some of these things are happening directly under your nose.
And what did they say to you? I mean, I can imagine Karabo Mokhonyane, a young woman, coming to speak to Khoshi and Baruti about issues sexual. I can imagine that can be a very difficult situation. I mean, besides the conservative nature of that space, but the patriarchy that might also exist in that space, the very idea that it's taboo for a young woman to be speaking of such issues with a man of that level of status in that space. How do you break that? You understand why I'm trying to understand the intervention you bring at that very granular level, because I'm trying to figure out why is it with all of the knowledge that we have, with all of the education that we have, and with all of the policies that I hope mean well, why it is that we find that the policies don't find ground manifestation. Why? And it's not just in South Africa. It's all over Africa and maybe in other parts of the world, but it's so pronounced on our continent and in our country. And I don't understand why that's the case, unless I start to entertain ideas of what I call Kidzwile number one syndrome, and I'll talk to you about that in a few moments' time. But tell me how you bridge that gap. If you're trying to bring certain levels of consciousness around sexuality, intersectionality, all of those wonderful concepts, humanity in that whole conversation, in a context of deep traditional conservative value systems where a Karabo, with all of her education and all of her well-meaning and all of her ability to interpret policy and align. You understand what I'm saying? Why is it that these things don't work for our people?
Okay, so I'll start with the how it went. So let me just put out, it took the whole day. Definitely.
It was, I can imagine.
Yeah, it was definitely a very, firstly, controversial one. The uptake was, it was tough. It was definitely a tough one. But I think as a team, we then had to strategize. And I think that's where strategy is everything. We had to pre-think, what are we dealing with and who are we dealing with? And how then do we get to a point whereby they feel heard, they feel respected? Because there's those aspects, you know.
Say, of course.
Exactly.
I can imagine that. How do you even start? Let me quickly tell you a story. Quickly, I'll tell you a quick story. So many, many years ago, I had a gig. Many, many years ago, I was a youngster myself. I was working with some people at the Human Rights something. I can't remember. And it was a survey to go and check the behaviors of certain men in certain communities and how they are connected to the spread of HIV and AIDS. This was like in 1991, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember coming into this homestead and finding this ubaba. You understand what I mean?
Yeah.
And I had this paper and this pencil, and I started to ask these questions that were written in English. Mm-hmm. And I had to ask them in the vernacular. And I had to, you're beginning to see the problem here. So I had to ask questions in English that said, how many sexual partners do you have? What sexual behaviors do you enjoy engaging in? This is in English.
Okay.
Right? This is in English, right? Which sexual activities do your partner enjoy with you? Right? This is in English.
Sure.
Now, I was at a hostel.
Okay.
where I was speaking to a ubaba. It was a very difficult moment. It was a very, very difficult moment because when I tried to translate into isiZulu what I was reading in English, it didn't go down very well. Now, I was a male. I'm trying to think how issues of sexuality and that kind of conversation would happen with a Muruti or a Khosh of the most conservative type, how a young woman, Karabo, would traverse that. I'm really looking at the practicalities of it. What were some of the difficulties that you experienced in that process of that nature?
So I would say, firstly, the age gap. We are definitely, it's like an intergenerational gap between us. But I guess our strategy was, it wasn't just us. It wasn't like an us versus them. We really had a great pool of people. So even people who were trying to, some of the experts on our side were much older. We were just helping a lot with facilitating the engagement.
Yeah.
But I think just being sensitized and being aware of how they would like to be engaged, the language, the tone, the approach is everything.
Yes.
You know, there's that element of them wanting to feel respected, and we had to basically ensure that in every step of this process, they still feel respected, because ultimately we do want their uptake.
Yeah.
We do want them to hear what we have to say, but we also want them to feel heard.
Yeah.
So the NAC was also used. You know, things like those sort of strategies were very much used as well.
Right.
But also then hearing them. I think that was the biggest part, not just bringing them into a conference room and presenting what we have to say, but hearing what they actually have to say. And then also how we presented it. We had to use things like lived experiences. So like I said, some of the learners were there. We had people who, like Bomoruti, who were more on our side as well. So that was another thing. It's almost like people...
So they helped you with the translation of some of the concepts, yeah?
Absolutely. So that was another way, you know, to get people who are more on, you know, pro-comprehensive sexuality education, speak to, you know, they're basically speaking to each other because they understand each other. So we had to really strategize. It was definitely difficult. I mean, at some point, people just wanted to walk out. It was a whole, it was a whole thing. But ultimately, I think it was just that respect being there, but also coming down and speaking their language for them to be like, okay, we see what is happening.
So what was the outcome?
Okay, so the outcome was that, there was a high uptake. I mean, there were some that were still had reservations, and their reservations, particularly those on the traditional leadership side, they had a bit of reservations because it meant dismantling some of their practices. You know, things like...
Sure, it's taking some of their powers. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, basically, yes. Things like Ubutwala and stuff. So they then had some reservations. We had a bigger uptake, you know, surprisingly from the religious leaders more so. They were supportive of it, particularly because I think we hammered on how there has been mass abuse. And at the time, there was a lot of abuse going on in churches.
Yeah.
So we hammered heavily on that, and that's why it was a bigger uptake. Whereas I think with the traditional leaders, it was more like, these are practices, and these are the practices that we've always had, and you introducing this thing will kind of shake up our practices.
So, I mean, can you tell me that was successful?
I would say it was. I would say it was because even within it's not 100% all traditional leaders were against it. So we then had uptake from some of the traditional leaders. And what was quite interesting was the ones that really were supportive were more the women. And then then the women traditional leaders, or these wives of traditional leaders supporting it, women have power, so we hope that we will somehow partner with them to be able to get the message across. And what then had happened, I think, towards the end of the conversation, when we were trying to hear what the uptake is, some of them stood up and spoke about how important... They started convincing each other, basically. So it was almost like, our work is done. Convince each other somewhere, somehow. And they actually were just speaking amongst each other, talking about how it's not necessarily us encouraging sex, but it's rather us saying that there's specific things that learners and young people need to know, things like consent and that sort of thing. And then what then the next process was then was to review the curriculum to see what they feel like, you know, is necessary and what is not necessary. And that process is still going on.
011-883-0702, a South African doing great things. She's a legal and development practitioner. From Reform Envoy and a program director for SESI Fellowship. And yeah, the big task of trying to align policy and implementation in South Africa and why we don't see enough of it, why we don't see enough success in it. And they are the people that try to align policy and the implementation in the process of trying to bring development in many of our communities. I'd like to ask you, as you listen to this conversation, why do you think fundamentally we seem to have policies that are wonderful on paper? Yeah? Wonderful on paper. I mean, is that not what we talk about on a daily basis on these platforms, about our wonderful constitution, about our wonderful Bill of Rights, about our wonderful NDP, about our wonderful documents that we write, all these wonderful documents that seem not to have implementability on the ground? Give me a call and let me know what you think fundamentally the problem is. I'm going to share my theory with Karabo in a few moments' time.
Okay.
I was challenged earlier on, Karabo, by the CEO of Discovery Health the previous hour, Ryan Noach. And I said to him that some of my ideas, I don't know if South Africans are ready to hear yet. And he said, you have a responsibility to ventilate some of them. And I'm going to use you this evening. Karabo Mokgonyana, a South African doing great things. Where did you grow up, Karabo?
I grew up in Morato, Limpopo.
And tell me about that upbringing and how it has impacted your work at this stage of your career.
Yes, so it's mainly the first 8 years in Limpopo, so Kigwana Koko. I was raised by my great-grandmother.
Your great-grandmother, okay.
My great-grandmother.
Wow, yes. Lucky you, man, yeah.
I know, yeah. And I think just the village in which I grew up in, too much is going on, and I think it reflects a lot of the villages that exist in South Africa where you have, high levels of teenage pregnancy, alcoholism, the poverty is quite rife, and I think just growing up in that sort of context, I think my benefit is obviously partly living in Limpopo and then coming to Gauteng, then you really see the economic gaps that exist and how alarming it really is. So I think that highly influenced why I decided to get into this space. And I think most of the times people feel like, okay, it has to happen to me. But I always say I was privileged enough to be able to access the places that I've been able to. But that doesn't mean that I then can't go back and help my people who are going through very similar things. For some people, it's just a matter of getting an opportunity, getting information, getting resources, but also then things like holding leaders accountable, ensuring that public budgets are spent well, things like that. We need to, as a public, do something, and I wanted to do something about it.
I want to take a break. When we come back, I'd like to take some of your calls on 011-883-0702 about why do you think we have this perpetual gap between policy and implementation in our country and in our continent? Why is it that that seems to beat us all the time, that we need to have people like Karabo Mokonyana to keep us reminded about our priorities? Why is it that, because, you know, people like Karabo Mokonyana are not going to do this for free. she shouldn't do it for free. But we have government departments that are staffed with people who invariably have to get Karabo to come and do their work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, give me a call. I'd love to hear your thoughts about this on 011-883-07. I have some theories about this. I'm going to share them with Karabo when I come back. Some fundamental theories as to what do we think about ourselves that creates this reality. Give me a call. I'd love to hear from you. 011-883-0702. Karabo Mokonyane is a South African doing great things.
South Africans doing great things.
Her name is Karabo Mokonyana, and she's a South African doing great things. She's a legal and development practitioner for Reform Envoy and a program director for CSC Fellowship. Had the fortune of having been raised by her great-grandmother. What are some of the biggest things that you think your great-grandmother instilled in you in terms of values, Karabo?
Okay. I think because we didn't really have much, I think just I resonate, and often it's quite cliche when it comes to Ubuntu, but I heavily resonate with it, just the aspects of humanity, respect, because, you know, when you then are raised in a household where you don't have much, those are the things that weigh heavy, and those are the things that really matter. And I think that's what I've heavily carried throughout my journey and my career. And that's what's held me. And I'm very grateful for that.
So here goes, right?
Okay.
What one of the things that I found to be quite insidious in the way that we as African people think about ourselves, that is pervasive, that is everywhere, deceptively ubiquitous, is the idea of Hotswa number one.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed that in multiracial schools, or perhaps what we used to call white schools back in the day, the idea of first position, coming number one, was less pronounced than it was in our schools.
Mm.
And what that did is that it created the idea that you could achieve a particular status in any community by wanting to leave the bulk of the community and be number one. In other words, to be the elite.
Mm-hmm.
It created a reality where to be separate from the rest of the group was rewarded by status.
Mm-hmm.
So out with the number one, you always had the status of being the one that is taken to stand up in front of the class and for you to be the aspiration. But the converse of that is that you, who is number one, looks down upon the class, the group, and you don't want to be associated with it. In fact, you associate with something else. Give a call. And so that's why you see that most of the number ones always wanted to be the first black what. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
And the net result of that ethos, of that whole space, of that whole psychological framework, is that it creates an us and them and aspiration to be like the others kind of reality. Mm-hmm. Where the masses, the people, are nothing but a laboratory where we experiment with stuff and ideas. Mm-hmm. But they're not really people. They're just a laboratory where we experiment with ideas that we've learned in the institutions where we became number one. Mm-hmm. But our real lives, Rona Barit Vileng number one, are aspirationally lived Koskhoi.
Yeah.
And so the people don't matter, because actually they're not people. They are cannon fodder. They are the proverbial laboratory where we try out all sorts of social experiments. They're not people. They are a canvas where we can express our number one intellect. Does that make sense?
It does.
And my sense is that that is why post-liberation, post-colonial liberation, the reality of neo-colonialism took such great root, because most of the leaders who became leaders post-colonialism became even worse oppressors of the people than their erstwhile oppressors, because they were the number ones. I argue that the policies that are crafted in the offices and the corridors of the number one elite groups have nothing to do with the people, because the people don't exist in the minds of the crafters of the policies. They don't see the people as people. They see them as a tool for experimentation. And that is why we don't see the implementation of policy, because policy is nothing more than a way by which our number ones brag to the aspirational crowd that they are aspiring to try and show that we are actually capable and clever enough to live in your world, because we are number one in the world that which we come from, that we don't want to be a part of. Discuss, comment, Karabo.
Okay. I agree. I absolutely agree. I didn't think the position was very deep. It's very clear. It's rooted in, you know, a lot more around, you know, like just humanity, social science and philosophy. And you are right. And that's why the deep-rooted gaps. I mean, as we work, sometimes we just see like, okay, how did this policy even pass the mark of being approved?
Yeah.
Because it's so bad, and it, you know, like you say, a lot of it doesn't speak to the people. It doesn't really reflect the needs of the people, the issues of the people. And it is quite like a very sad process in that money is wasted even just drafting those policies. And then you wonder, at what point do we then have a very deep and informed type of policy strategy? And yeah, I think, but then, I mean, there are different factors. There's politics, there's timelines, there's budget.
Sure.
And I think those are the things they prioritize for sure.
How do we change this reality? How do we create policies that are meaningful to the people for which they are meant? How do we do this?
I would say public accountability is the only way I foresee this happening. I think those who have the knowledge, the access, really need to stand up and hold leaders accountable. I mean, we've seen some of the crucial policies and laws where there's public participation and public accountability take time. And that's because people don't want it to just be anything, like the NHI that you guys were talking about.
Yeah.
That is taking time because people are not just going to accept anything in it, like anything mediocre. Same thing with the land conversation. The public participation is has been so massive there, and the accountability, because people are like, you have to do it right with the NHI, with the land issue. You really have to do it right. And I think those are just a few examples whereby people are hands-on. The public is definitely holding policymakers and the lawmakers accountable, but we don't see that in a lot of the others. Mm. And that is not to blame the public, because a lot of the times, none of these things are visible. You know, they just gather the people that they know will not question a lot of the processes, and then they move forward with it. So I think just the visibility as well is something that's problematic, but also stuff like access, and not just access in the sense of access to these spaces. If you're going to do a policy, language barrier is something in question. So things like that are so important. Literacy is another thing. So you need to make sure that they're accessible to the public at large.
Wasn't it interesting that at the coronation of the king in KwaZulu-Natal, the whole thing happened in English?
Yeah. Yeah, it was. It really was.
Karabo, tell me where to from here for Karabo Mokonyan.
So next year, I will be joining the Constitutional Court.
Yes.
So just doing some of the essential constitutional work. But I equally continue to do a lot more like column and opinion contributions on speaking on some of these essential issues and topics. And yeah, I think doing also a lot of grassroots work.
Yeah.
I really value, I like the high level stuff and it's fine, but I think we need to see a lot more grassroots work. And one of the biggest things that we then want to do is lobby for a lot of resources to come down.
As I stand up and salute you for your work, for your advocacy work, for your intellectual work, for your humanity work, for your legal work, keep going, don't stop. I want to thank you for agreeing to talk to us. I want to thank you for the work that you're doing. I want to thank you for the consciousness that you bring to the work that you're doing. And I know we're going to hear more about Karabo Mokonyane in the future. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, she makes us proud to call ourselves South African. Karabo Mokonyane, South African.